Welcome to this Frequency Matters podcast, Making Sense of Low Power Wide Area Networks. I'm Pat Hindle, and I'm here with Thomas Lorbach, Product Manager for Sub-6 GHz RF Solutions at NXP, and Tom Pennell, Senior Director of Marketing for Edge Processing at NXP. Welcome, both of you.
Thank you.
Hello.
Many of the new IoT connections will take advantage of the latest 5G capabilities to support cutting-edge use cases like self-driving cars, virtual reality headsets, high-resolution camera systems, and autonomous drones. But there'll also be kind of a dramatic growth in IoT connections that don't really need this advanced performance, and it would be available with 5G. The small battery-operated devices, such as sensors that collect and transmit readings from the use in manufacturing, agriculture, healthcare, utility grids and urban infrastructures and asset tags, they will track things and report, but they don't need that high data rate. And they'll be communicating with the cloud too, but in a very low data rate sense. The sensors and asset tags are often deployed in places that don't reach with Wi-Fi, so they need some other pipeline, especially like in agricultural fields and other uses that require mobility. To service this segment, the IoT device to cloud connections will make use of the low power wide area networks. And that's a wireless technology that offers low bandwidth, energy efficient connectivity, and low data rates over long ranges. During today's episode, we're going to talk about making sense of all these low power wide area network technologies and what applications are best positioned to serve them. So let's kind of start off with, what is a low power wide area network? You know, how do you define them so that everybody's kind of on the same playing field?
Yeah, so I'll start with that. In the simplest terms, when I think of a low power wide area network, I think of it as a sleepy end device. And there's a couple of characteristics there. One, it communicates over a long distance, so generally a kilometer or more, and it runs on a battery. And it's generally distributed, a distributed application where there's going to be several sensors or actuators. So a good way to think about this is either in a city or an agricultural setting is really a great spot for low power wide area networks. And Thomas, maybe you can add a little bit more there.
Yeah, usually I would agree with this, with the exception, of course, it's not necessarily battery powered, but often these devices are. When you look at the metering industry, who's been using these low power wide area network and neighborhood area networks, they've been in the field for many, many years. And basically all the data in some of these metering infrastructure is being monitored and collected with low power wide area network technology, such as Wi-SUN.
Yeah, so a lot of these are also operated by a carrier. Sometimes they're not operated by a carrier. So an example of a low power wide area network might be something proprietary that's purpose built and monitored specifically by the company that implemented it. That might be something like LoRaWAN, for example. That would be proprietary and purpose built. And then you've got other ones that are more built and monitored by providers, network providers, such as Sigfox or AT&T or Verizon in the US, for example.
Yeah, I think that's basically one of the big differences that we have to look here. Some of this is really proprietary, metering companies having their own protocol modulation scheme, frequency bands that they are deploying for those kind of applications. But for a lot of companies, especially those networks that are being operated by a third party, will create a lot of value because at the end of the day, they only have to worry about the sensor nodes themselves. And they don't have to worry about a network infrastructure or maintaining such a network infrastructure.
Yeah, that's true. When I think about these proprietary ones, one of the challenges that you have there is it becomes hard to change or to switch when, you know, if you're a city and you're committing to a wide area network, and, you know, if it's proprietary, that becomes difficult for those providers. So, you know, that's where some of these more open standards can be an advantage.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, another interesting one, Thomas, that you and I have talked about in the past is Sidewalk from Amazon. This is an example of a crowdsourced LPWAN. And the reason it's crowdsourced is because it doesn't rely on any particular entity to deploy the base station, if you will. Do you have any thoughts on Sidewalk in, or more specifically, crowdsourced networks?
Yeah, so if you think about it, for Amazon, Sidewalk makes a lot of sense. I mean, there's millions of these Alexa things out in the field, and enhancing those with a long-range communication interface that basically covers the outside of your house, but potentially also your neighbor's house and the next one maybe. There's a lot of data that can be collected. You know, some people keep talking about the dog that runs away. I think it's a bad example, but Amazon deliveries could be a use case for that. The idea behind this is really great. I mean, makes a lot of sense. However, I've got one caveat to it though. In a professional environment, these are basically crowdsourced networks, and that also means they are not professionally maintained. So in a business-to-business environment, that could become actually quite a bit of a challenge to use those networks, because you've got no control over it and you cannot guarantee the service. But for consumer applications, absolutely brilliant.
Can you also cover like the standard base ones like NB-IoT, LTE-M, you know, kind of what's the difference and how those are based on different standards?
Yeah, with NB-IoT, Sigfox, and LTE-M, we are basically talking here about those networks that are being operated by companies, NB-IoT, LTE-M, predominantly by the traditional mobile phone network operators. Sigfox itself provides only the technology, but it has got a number of operators that are establishing the Sigfox network in various countries. Just to give you an example, Japan, for example, the network operator is a company called Kyocera, which a lot of people may know. It's a well-known large-scale electronics company in Japan. We've got in Europe a company called Heliot, a very financially big, stable company that is operating their network in Germany, Austria, Switzerland, and Slovenia. There's also WND, who run the network in the UK and in a lot of countries in South America.
So let's move into the use cases. What are the use cases that are well suited for this technology?
So I'll start here. So, you know, this is really in, you know, you can kind of think about this as what's happening today versus what's going to happen in the future. So I think the obvious things today are things like smart metering, condition monitoring, and just effectively distributed sensors that are part of a smart city infrastructure or as part of just a general infrastructure. And I think that's how most people view LPWAN today. As I think Thomas alluded to earlier, he talked about this distinction between a business-to-business and reliability that's needed versus consumer quality that's needed. And I really see this, before I get into that though, I really see this as emerging, and it's really going to explode in terms of how LPWAN will be part of our everyday life in the future. But before I get into that, I mean, maybe we should talk a little bit more about, if we want to go a level deeper into the use cases that we see that are existing today. Thomas, I know you're pretty involved in some of these, particularly the asset tracking space. Maybe you can comment on that a bit.
Yeah, the asset tracking is a new field, actually. In my view, it is a new field. So we've got a lot of legislation ongoing. There's a lot of requirements coming up. For example, I'll just give you an example, food safety. Basically, they call it from farm to shelf. So that's basically really from the farm through a distribution center into the grocery store, where they want to monitor the food along the whole supply chain. There's more and more legislation coming in there that guarantees that cool chain's been kept and those kind of things, which in 10 years ago, basically nobody was really looking at, or basically just relying on some data that was stored on the cooling truck, that everything was all right. But there have been instances where this wasn't the case, where food was actually not cooled enough. So that's, you know, the consumer is demanding more, in reality, more information about the quality of stuff. And expanding this beyond the production process is something that people are looking at, and that means the full transparency also outside of your own manufacturing or farm environment, that you can basically cross from there to the end customer and have got a pretty good view of the product and its status along the way.
Yeah, I think you're right. Asset tracking is maybe it's new, but it's an established kind of thought that I think a lot of people are exploring today, even though, as you say, it is new. Smart metering is, I think, is still emerging and it's still happening, but it's well established. And, you know, we see smart metering still to be a pretty big market for LPWAN. You know, this has huge benefits for utilities in terms of being able to report out, you know, energy consumption real time without sending people or trucks out to the field. So you have a combination of collectors that are, you know, collecting the information in a neighborhood or in an apartment complex. And then you've got, you know, backhaul that's pulling all that together. And then the meter, of course, is connected with these low power wide area networks. And these are largely managed and implemented by large companies like Landis+Gyr Gear and Itron and others that are deploying these networks in the field today. I think about this, though, you know, how do we take this to the next level of IoT for others? And I think there's always going to be a spot in the market, even in the consumer space, for these well-managed, very reliable networks that are provided by operators. And we're going to see that as the value of tracking that asset is high. I think as the value of that is high, it will warrant that continuous monthly charge of maintaining and monitor and maintaining and building out that network. But I also think about what can happen in the consumer space. Let's say, for example, as a manufacturer of a coffee pot or a weigh scale, you just want a simple way of adding your product to the cloud. And, you know, in many cases, people don't bother to connect their smart thing to the cloud, or they don't know how to connect it to the cloud, or, you know, because it's not working well with their, you know, their current router, they don't connect it to the cloud. I mean, when you I can see a point in the future where you unbox something, you put a battery in, and it's automatically connected to your preferred, ecosystem where you you buy it from, let's say, Amazon, or you buy it or you can scan this thing with a QR code and it just automatically connects to your ecosystem without having to connect it to Wi-Fi or connect it to a Thread or Zigbee network in your home. So I can see device manufacturers wanting to take advantage of these low power wide area networks in a way that is different than they are today. Today, you have to pay for getting connected to the infrastructure. But tomorrow, I think there'll be different ways or different business models that develop around low power wide area networks that will allow you to connect out of the box without you having to connect to your router and bring value to the consumer that way. And these new business models will be more around features and data and advertising and just interaction with consumers or continued interaction with consumers. And this is something that low power wide area networks can enable over time as the infrastructure builds out and as the device costs come down and make it trivial to add to a device.
Oh, I really like that idea. I want to be able to just automatically connect because that's always the hardest part. So can you tell us what are the major differences between each technology?
Thomas, maybe you can start this one.
Yeah, from a technical point of view, I mean, for the most part, the differences are in data rate, very simple. We've got some that are extremely slow, like Sigfox data transfer. It's just 100 bits per second or maybe 600 bits per second in the US. But we are also seeing with NB-IoT and LTE-M, obviously, hundreds of kilobits per second in data transfer. The other thing is, of course, modulation scheme, but that's really not that dramatic in my view, at the very least. I mean, there is various modulation schemes out of there, and everybody claims this one has this advantage and this one has this advantage. Certainly, there is a relationship between modulation scheme, data rate, and range. That's very obvious for engineers, at the very least it is. But what it also comes down to is whether there is a free band being used, which is without any license fee. For example, that's in Europe, the 868 megahertz band. In the US, it's the 902 up to 928 megahertz, I believe. These are free bands anybody can use. So there's always a little bit the view, if somebody is occupying that band quite heavily, it may interfere with some of those low power wide area network technologies. And then we've got, obviously, the mobile phone operators who are operating their devices usually in a band that they really own and they can use it for themselves. NB-IoT, as far as I understand it, takes actually a bit of the band of an LTE channel, just a small proportion, really. It's not really that dramatic, but it falls basically within the network operator-owned frequency band. So that's one of the things. And then depending on how you structure your low-power wide area network, if you want to have a full duplex connection, so you're sending data forth and back and you receive, and receiving is almost as quick as sending out data, that has got a significant impact on hardware cost, but also on battery lifetime, right? And then there is other technologies. With Sigfox, you can have the option to have a transmitter only, so you're basically saving yourself the whole receive chain, which has a significant impact on chip and module cost.
So what is the current adoption rate of these technologies?
I think this is a little bit of a difficult one. Depends on where you're looking at. As Tom pointed out, the metering industry has been putting these things in place for quite a while now. I can refer, for example, to the UK Smart Metering Program, which is basically bringing the whole country into the smart metering stage, where meters can be used for load management. I've got a backhaul connection, sometimes wireless, LTE based, GSM based. There's also a proprietary 400 megahertz low power wide area network being deployed that depends on the region of the UK. So that's, in my view, very mature, right? That's been around for a number of years and it's been in use. Itron and Landis and Gear were mentioned. They are doing similar things. But then we've got a lot of customers, you know, where I would say it's early adopters, or even that stage before early adopters. There is a whole group of customers out there which have traditionally not been exposed to electronics whatsoever. They didn't need it, but now that they are trying to track and trace their supply chain, the individual steps within it, they are basically getting into that technology side of it, putting engineers in place to have a look at this, running test programs. Just a quick example for that is, we know, for example, that there is a manufacturer of plastic boxes. They produce plastic boxes in the millions over past 20, 30 years, never been exposed really to electronics. And they are now thinking of making boxes, you know, that are track and traceable with low power wide area technology. For them, this is an entirely new field.
Yeah, these technologies really open up new things or new ways of thinking and doing more services that we never really thought were possible before. So what are some of the hot markets for the wide area networks that are low power?
Yeah, so I would say like the smart city for sure is a hot market. We still see a lot of activity there. And when I talk about smart city, that includes metering, but it also includes these distributed sensor networks for water quality, for water flow, for, you know, various types of, you know, activities. You know, this is constantly evolving. And, you know, as we talked about earlier, there's just different, these are just at different stages of their development. The more consumer oriented wide area networks, I would say, are more emerging. But the industrial or smart city type networks, I would say, are more mature. So this is the key thing. It's really about the cost of the total cost of ownership of deploying a low power wide area network is still not, you know, free or low. You have to have a reason, a pretty significant business reason to want to do that. And therefore, you know, it's being generally done in higher value applications. But as the cost of hardware comes down, as the cost of maintaining and building out networks comes down, as the bandwidth becomes more available, these prices will come down, and we'll see it emerge more, I think, in the consumer space.
That's basically correct. I mean, for the consumer space, there's one thing you know people have to keep in mind usually is, it's the maturity of technology and the availability of the infrastructure itself that is pretty much a determining factor for use in a consumer environment. Just as an example, if you've got a million goods that you are shipping around and you're basically tagging and tracking those, usually you've got your back-end system and you can do a statistical evaluation of where things are, right? You know, on the truck there is 100 of these, and I haven't received a message from that guy, but you know, 20 others sent me some information, so I can logically infer that, you know, they are all still together and they are on the same track, and therefore they are moving all in the same direction, right? If you think about the consumer business, then the consumer buys something. For example, a very popular one for low power wide area tracking in Europe is the e-bike, right? People used to pay like $500 to $700 or something on average for a bicycle. That has almost doubled the expense that people are investing into bikes. And the driver for that is basically the e-bike. And a lot of these e-bikes, they either have an option at manufacturing site for a low power wide area type of tracking and anti-theft and whatever, or you can buy equipment that you can retrofit to the bicycle. Problem with this is somebody buys the bicycle, goes home, he wants to test the connection and it doesn't work because there is no coverage in that area. And then the disappointment is rather big. So for the consumer space to adopt any of this, the quality of the networks and the coverage of the networks is really an important factor. And it's also a deciding factor whether this is a hot market or not.
Yeah, so you mentioned that network quality is an issue. What are the main challenges and opportunities here?
Tom mentioned it already. Usually for a lot of customers, the challenge is the additional cost that comes into the game, subscription fees, the hardware needs to be developed, deployed, manufactured. So you need to have a really good business case with all of this, especially you need to have an outlook on getting good cost reduction over high volumes, right? And then the other thing is really, is the low power wide area technology that I'm choosing, is that where I'm operating, giving me enough coverage to get a reasonable amount of data so that I can do an analysis and see where my stuff actually is, right? So that's what I think are the two big challenges. And then the other one is, from a technical point of view, if you look at municipalities, right, individual cities, usually they are not network service provider or anything like this. They've got their street lighting systems which they are responsible for. They'd like to put a wireless radio in it with an on-off switch and some circuitry to monitor the health of the bulb. But they really don't want to operate a network, right? And therefore, network coverage is really important. The thing that we've seen, at the very least in large parts of Europe, maybe in Germany especially so, though, is you get good coverage in the big cities, right? Also with NB-IoT and whatever. But if you are going into the countryside, it may actually change quite dramatically. And that's where a lot of business cases then stop being a good business case, right? So the coverage, as I pointed out, that's just a given. It needs to be there, and there's little point in waiting forever that the operators put an antenna out there to allow you the services.
Yeah, well, another really interesting challenge here is that when a manufacturer deploys a product that's an IoT product, they have to consider a lot of things. You know, one is they're going to have a back-end cloud. They're going to have an app that's associated with that product. They're going to have in-field upgrades because inevitably there's some sort of bug that gets discovered or a security vulnerability or something like that. And these are kind of costs that that you know need to be managed well, and they're often misunderstood or not properly accounted for when the product is launched. So customers find themselves, or our customers or providers find themselves in a difficult situation where they're needing to maintain an app that they don't really have the core expertise to maintain. And so that's why we see some ecosystem and app consolidation happening. You see this in things like Matter, which is formerly known as Project Chip, where the ecosystem providers are allowing manufacturers to leverage their backend infrastructure and their apps for their products. And I could see that becoming part of these low power wide area networks as they become more consumer oriented, for example.
So how about power efficiency? How is that important here?
So power efficiency, from my perspective, I work in embedded processing, and embedded processing is really the heart of what we do. And connectivity is a way of connecting that thing to something, to a network. And so power is important because what we want to do is transmit and receive as little as possible. And so let's say we're trying to detect an event, or we're trying to do some AI or ML at the edge. Having the right processing power and managing how often you connect to the network is something that we think a lot about, because we want to provide that value at the edge, because I think we can do processing pretty efficiently on a battery at the edge, and even enable things like voice and some vision elements on higher end products that would prevent someone from having to go to the cloud to process that and send a lot of data. So for us, one angle that we look at NXP is how to manage that kind of interplay between the cloud and the edge, where we can do more processing at the edge to prevent us from having to actually send a lot of data to the cloud. So that's one way we manage power.
Well, you mentioned processing. What sort of processing is needed then?
Yeah, so it depends on the application, but like, let's say you have an application that is has a safety requirement. You may want to have dual core processing, where one of the cores manages the networking stack and the other one manages the safety elements of the product. So it's not necessarily a frequency element. It's sometimes can be just a partitioning of the application, as an example. So a 100 megahertz M33 core is probably ample for managing many applications and also managing a network. But then as the AI and ML ramp, meaning that you have more arithmetic happening, you need clock speeds, and you need multi-megahertz products to solve these problems. So it's really a range of processing that we have at NXP that solves a lot of different problems. And this goes all the way from like Linux based systems to real-time operating systems running at hundreds of megahertz down to systems that are just a couple hundred megahertz running on a coin cell. So it all depends on the battery size and the application you're trying to or the problem you're trying to solve.
So one thing I really worry about is security. We've seen all kinds of hacking being a big issue around the world. How do you maintain secure networks in this case?
Well, there's various ways of doing it, right? It all starts with an authentication, one way or the other, that the end device is actually the device that is allowed to talk to the network. With NB-IoT, LTE-M, we are seeing the traditional use of SIM cards as they are being used in mobile phones. Obviously, there is a trend or a view also to move to soft SIM at one point. If that's not happened already, I'm not even sure, maybe. But basically, there is established standards for encryption, authentication out there, which are used by the network operators, especially in the NB-IoT and LTE-M LTE-M market. Other devices, other networks using usually encryption. It's not uncommon, 128-bit AES encryption, 256, elliptic curve, the use of secure elements for the authentication, a good starting point. So that you can do a lot, basically, to make sure that the data privacy is being maintained.
Yeah, one of the things I'm all constantly amazed at is security seems to be the first thing that a lot of customers are willing to compromise on when they're looking at balancing cost versus functionality. And I'm always amazed by this. So one of the things that we're trying to do is make security fundamental to our products. So we're embedding secure enclaves into many of our devices now that you know, help with key management, help with you know, different ciphers, make the product more secure, make it so that it can't be tampered with. And if it is tampered with, it kind of lobotomizes itself, if you will. So we're trying to make it very difficult to to hack one of our devices. Now, it isn't obviously impossible, and someone with resources can do it, but we're trying to make it a high resource intensive thing. And if it does happen, they have to do that same level of resource investment on the next thing. So it's really a balance, and we're trying to incorporate that into our products. And I think this is an area where governments can really make an impact as they start to legislate acceptable levels of security. This is something that a government can positively impact and really help with the deployment of low power wide area networks and make it secure and trusted, you know, worldwide.
So you brought up the subject of cost. How will we make this technology deliver really good ROI?
Yeah, so from my point of view, we have to continuously drive the cost down of a device to make it so that a customer can, without even thinking too much, incorporate this as part of their end product. We have to make these hidden fees that I talked about earlier around, apps and, provisioning and decommissioning and, maintenance of the product. We need to make that easy through applications and partnerships with ecosystems. So, I mean, these are some ways that I think we can help on the cost side from a business perspective. I don't know, Thomas, if you have anything to add there on cost.
I mean, at the end of the day, yeah, cost drive is that's basically our business, right? Over volume, driving the cost down. But we're not alone in this game, right? There's subscription fees potentially, data fees, and those kind of things. I mean, they're also, you need, in order to get a good contract with good terms, you need to have a lot of volume that you are sending around. And as I said, for some of those markets, we are really at the beginning, where on the outside it looks, rather expensive, but once you get to volume contracts, the situation is much improving. Yeah.
So how will these technologies be complemented by other wireless technologies? You have RFID, near field communications, low energy Bluetooth, ultra wideband, and similar technologies.
Yeah, that's an interesting one, because a lot of this may actually be dual purpose if you look at this. So RFID, that's been around for a while now. It's shipping in the billions. It's really cheap, but it only covers basically the manufacturing sites themselves and the distribution centers and maybe the retailers. Bringing that to the next level, in this case, then you may think about a combination of those two things to basically bridge the gap for all product that is in transit. At the same time, we've got technologies like NFC, that's not so much for tracking, but it's an interesting feature set for consumers to use their mobile phone to configure data, to turn things on, off, enable feature sets, for example, like a bicycle lock, for example. You can lock and unlock with NFC interface, so that works quite well. BLE, for example, that's an interesting one because we've got two things that we can do with BLE. We can, on the one hand, we can have establish a communication with a mobile phone, with a little app, make a configuration. But at the same time, we can also use BLE beacons for location services so that we know where things are, right? And the same is also true for ultra wideband, which you may have seen. There's two major mobile phone makers have put it into their standardization ongoing, and ultra wideband has got certainly some great potential in the future as a new technology for location services, right? There's other things you could use like GPS, right? But it's firstly not something that we have, but at the same time, that's where people need to be a little bit more cautious, the power consumption of such GPS devices is actually fairly high in comparison to the low power wide area network technology. So if you wanted to run off a coin cell for many years, then that's probably not the way to go. Similarly, Wi-Fi, you probably a lot of people know that, but Wi-Fi SSIDs that are flying around in the air, those can be read, they can be transmitted with low power wide area network technology into the cloud, and Google tells you exactly where that network is, right? So you've got a very good location service also with these technologies these days.
Yeah, you mentioned UWB. That's a really interesting one. Getting back to an application you talked about earlier, of asset tracking. I mean, GPS is a clear way of doing asset tracking, but what happens when you go into a large building? What happens if you want to track that asset really to a precise location in a large building? Maybe it's multi-floor like a skyscraper, or it's a large warehouse. UWB, there could be a nice handoff between GPS and UWB as it moves indoors, where you could literally track something within, you know, a few centimeters if you wanted to, using UWB. So there's kind of like a different potential use for those. So GPS outdoors, UWB as it moves indoors, and you know, these are very complementary and would work well with these low power networks.
Yeah, and sometimes it's only one of them that you really need, right? GPS, for example, or ultra wideband, indoor, outdoor. If you think about manufacturing distribution centers, within the centers, you want to exactly know where things are, probably with, you know, a meter of accuracy. Ultra wideband would give you that one. But then if you load the whole thing on a truck, right, and you send it off the road, is it really reasonable to assume that you need the accuracy of a GPS radio, or will an NB-IoT or Sigfox triangulation be good enough, because the truck is moving with 50 miles an hour down the road anyway? So whether you've got an accuracy of 100 meter left or right, and there's a motorway in the middle, that's potentially good enough for you to know where things are.
So let's talk about how NXP is enabling the development of these low power wide area networks through products. What are you guys doing in that area?
Well, I'll start. So on we have a reference platform that we've developed with several partners actually. So we at the core of all of these systems is an MCU, and it's either going to be sensing or actuating or calculating something. And so we bring that together with products from a company called Sequans that has developed a LTEM and NB-IoT product with their Monarch Go line, They have a module that we've integrated, pre-integrated into our development boards. We have software and that we provide that that makes it easy to get started. We've partnered with Verizon. So out of the box, you have a Verizon data plan. And we've also partnered with Microsoft, which gives you immediate cloud connectivity. So right out of the box, you apply a battery, your kit's connected. It shows you exactly how to work with the Monarch Go product, how to provision your product onto a Verizon network and work with the Microsoft Cloud. And you get this all for $99 out of the box. We worked closely with Avnet, who is one of our distributors and a distributor of Sequans, and they provide this bundled kit on their online store for $99. So it's really easy to get started.
From our side, my business is predominantly focusing on Sigfox technology today. We've got some sub-gigahertz transceivers that we are using for various other things as well, like Zigbee in the UK for the sub-gigahertz link. We are looking also into other standards to be supported, but most mature, we are on the side of Sigfox. And we're going to release a new development kit next month. It's basically an Arduino shield that delivers the Sigfox functionality and has got an NXP MEM sensor on there for basically accelerometer measurements. For the host processing, we are basically deploying an NXP Kinetis K32L ARM microcontroller. It's one of the M0 series, so it's gear M0 plus, I believe. So it's geared to low power consumption per duty cycle, so that customers can actually develop an application with low power consumption. Besides that, this kit will be available with 14 dBm output for Europe and a 23 dBm version for the United States. And basically a Sigfox subscription for 1 year is included in the package. Besides that, we are working with a Taiwanese module maker, a company called Innocom. They provide for ease of the process stages and manufacturing readily certified modules. So these Sigfox modules, they carry our chip, the firmware. They are FCC, ETSI, and CE certified. So that makes it much, much easier to integrate the RF side of it, because that's usually the more complicated part in the development phase. RF engineers, it's sometimes a little bit difficult to get your hands on. Last but not least, we've got a couple of reference designs that we are currently deploying with some customers for the field testing. They can be rather complicated with GPS, NFC, motion sensor, a high accuracy microcontroller in terms of temperature measurement, very complex system. And it could also be a combination of a Sigfox chip with a real-time clock and maybe an NFC device to have a customer interface. Those are right now boards that we are using for the field trials and are still in the process of improving those. But one way or the other, I think they will be available in the market as reference designs later in the year.
Great. Well, thank you, Tom and Thomas, for joining me today to discuss the low power wide area networks and how they're enabling IoT applications. I definitely have a much better understanding of the use cases and opportunities here. So thank you for that. Thanks, everybody, for listening today, and join us soon again for another episode of Frequency Matters Podcast.